here we go, 9:06. Ursula, I haven't seen Tom since yesterday afternoon when he came around the corner laughing heartily at me. Oh, Tommy, there you are. Oh, big, big laughy laugh.
I've got the video to prove it.
Was he laughing at that hot tub
no,
picture?
No, no. No, something far more embarrassing.
I'm wondering if we should post it or not.
Should we put it up? All right, we'll talk about it later. Who has it, Jerry?
Yeah.
Did you watch him videotape it?
No, I didn't watch him videotape it, but he showed me the videotape after he videotaped it.
All right. There's an excuse for why I did that. Here we go.
You're just a weakling.
No.
Oh, okay. Is that why you had to get big, burly?
Oh, yeah, I'm moving on. The story that we're now getting from the shooting that occurred outside of Houston there at that high school is that the kid went in and was targeting one particular person. He killed, what, two teachers? Mm-hmm. And he went after one particular girl for the reason that he had asked her out a number of times on dates. She kept turning him down. And in a way, this girl almost predicted her own death, didn't she, Tom?
Yes, this is according to Daily Mail, which often gets the story first, but not always the most accurately. But I think we've now sort of checked enough sources that there seems to be more truth to this than not. Mm-hmm. And that is, there was a 16-year-old girl named Shayna Fisher, and he had been pestering her for dates for about 4 months. And she finally, a week ago Friday, so a week before the shooting, she had finally just sort of told him flat out, cut it out. Mm-hmm. At the time, she told her mother, the girl told her mother,
yeah,
that she felt like she might die at his hands. And the quote that we're getting is that, if he kills me, I'll haunt him forever. Mm-hmm. And again, according to the Daily Mail, they think that he targeted her first. Mm-hmm. He killed her first. There are reports that, again, this is a great aunt of the mother, you know, who says that she was shot in the face and was unrecognizable. They couldn't even have the mother come down and identify her own daughter. But the idea is, this is the first hint that there might be a motive. Mm-hmm. At this point, we haven't heard anything from anything regards motive. And this is not coming from police. This is not coming from any lawyers. This is not coming from anybody but speculation by the family of one of the victims. But it's pretty horrifying if any of this is true.
How about the fact that the mother says, I don't want to seek the death penalty? Now, because of his age, it wouldn't be available anyway. She said, I'm not there to judge. Mm-hmm. And she forgives him and says that he is a troubled person who obviously needs help. And she says her faith in Jesus Christ allows her to do that.
That's true.
And that is just, what, 2 days after? They probably even haven't buried the girl yet.
Oh, as far as I can tell, they hadn't even officially identified her from the family. But it's pretty horrific.
Doesn't that buckle your knees when someone's able to say, I forgive somebody?
Yes, I'm proud of it. I mean, being somebody who's against the death penalty anyway, I'm always amazed at someone. It's one thing for somebody like me to theoretically say, yes, I'm opposed to the death penalty. For somebody who has experienced something this in the moment of grief.
No, beyond the death penalty. Beyond the death penalty. Beyond the idea that the state takes a life. To the idea that you can sit there and say, because of my faith in God, I forgive you. That's far more freeing than seeing somebody injected with a lethal dose of something that stops the heart.
Absolutely. Right. That's what I was saying. That it's one thing for me to theoretically say I'm opposed to death penalty, but for someone who actually was in the midst of this and to say, yes, no, I seek forgiveness for even this person is a high-minded thing, and I applaud that.
I had seen one time on Oprah, they had a woman on there, and she forgave the killer of her daughter live on television while he was in prison. It's unbelievable. It just takes your breath away. Let's see.
One of the things I think, just to sort of jump on this, there was a lot of talk about the incel community in the last shooting, and these are the involuntary celibate. And one of the things they said is that for some reason, and this is every boy and every girl goes through heartbreak, often in high school, when things don't go the way they want it to go. But there's the sense of a boy's sense of entitlement. If I want you, how dare you reject me? That's the kind of mentality that we really have to kind of watch out for at maybe especially this age. But again, we have cases where this happens when people in their 20s and 30s and 40s too, if they feel like their love interest is no longer returning the favor.
Well, unrequited love has been a theme for anybody who's ever written about love for years. So the idea of somebody's going to kill somebody because they can't have that person, that's pretty standard. That's a crime of passion.
I mean, I guess, is it a passion or is it a sign of entitlement? It's one thing if you're married to somebody or your long-term boyfriend, girlfriend who break up. Even then, though, that shouldn't be allowed.
See, you've heard it said.
Unrequited love used to be, in the Middle Ages, unrequited love was seen as the highest badge of honor. Mm-hmm. That you love this person even without the love in response. Here, instead of, you know, sort of taking that wound, instead they lash out and kill their supposed object of love.
The old thing, you hear it said that if I can't have you, no one will.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's see, a week after the controversial jobs tax, the Seattle City Council wants to go back at it again and tax you again. This is an old tax that was built to expire, or not expire, but they need to vote on a new levy, and they want to include another $5, is it a week, or $5 a month on top of the already burgeoning property tax that you pay.
So what this was when it was passed in 2014, it was to start allowing for preschool kids that was, I'm not quite sure how many of these. It was like an experiment. They had 850 kids who went to preschool on the city's dime.
Yeah, it was a free preschool that was set up, and they wanted to expand from 300 to 1,000. And the cost, as they sort of scale these things up. I saw that KUOW did a story where they went in and they found a group that went in to sort of look and see how the schools are doing. And they're failing on the academic, and on a scale of 1 to 7. They get a 6.8 when it comes to emotional support for the child. But when it comes to academics, where they're trying to reinforce word choices, learning, math, skill, and counting, they got a 3. Out of 7. When they're asked about it, the Seattle City Council or the Seattle School District that's running this program said, well, you know what? It's always hard in the first couple of years to get good teachers in there because we're not paying enough, or we have to train these teachers a little better. So now they want to come back and they want to expand the program and have more free preschool for the folks in Seattle.
Okay, but so this is what's crucial about this, though, is this is for low income kids to go to preschool for free. That's the thing, because any of us who've had kids in the last, I mean, my kids, this is 20 years ago, but preschool is unbelievably expensive here in Seattle, and I'm sure anywhere in the Puget Sound area. And so if you're low income, you tend not to have access to preschool. So this is I wanted to get the numbers up, but low income kids to go to a preschool, 850 families were impacted, and so they want to expand that.
What do you think low income means?
I don't know. I mean, there's some. Is it like
300% of poverty? You know what that is?
I was going to say, whatever. It's a percentage.
Yeah, so it's a family of four. Yeah. That's $60,480.
Yeah, for a family of four.
No, family of three. That's three. Four is 70-something, some thousand dollars.
Family, living in Seattle.
Yeah tough. Mom that said she sends her kid there because she goes, it's the cheapest thing I could find. It's only $500 for her, and it ends up being just a better investment. So they want to expand it. They want to make sure that more people have an opportunity to have it. I like the fact that they are putting, you have to get a certain amount of money in order to get into the program. Originally, they were going to have everybody in because they said, we don't want to have just poor kids in here. We want rich kids so that we can sort of have this mixing of rich and poor and sort of not have this divide. But then people went after them and said, you know, come on now. You're going to let the poor, rich people have it? This doesn't seem fair. Make it just for people that truly need it.
Well, since we're only affording, at least in the 2014, only for 850 families, if we want to expand that, my hunch is that in order to pay for it, we can't afford, or we haven't, Seattle City Council hasn't decided to spend it.
So new property tax will come in place. You get a chance to vote on it in November. I think at that point, I think there's a number of taxes that could be voted upon. Also, you'll have the jobs tax, and you'll have the school tax will be in there. I think people will get a little tax weary, and we'll see how which way that one goes. Because I think included in that, they also want to have free community college.
Well, that's another thing.
There, right?
I don't know if that's a ballot issue. That's something that the mayor's office is pushing for.
But I think that might be in the levy. They want to spend $7 million, and they want to let everybody in, regardless of their grades or their income, to get quote-unquote free community college. And I think $7 million was the first part of it. Now they want to expand it, and they want to be able to have it offered to more kids, and that will be, I think, included in that levy that you have a chance to vote on in November. So if you think it's a good idea, who's somebody who might make $200,000 a year gets a chance to send their kid to community college for free, if you're in favor of that, then vote yes on that levy.
Well, I don't know that that's the case. I mean, do you have something there? Because the Q13 story doesn't mention that. It just mentions that there is this push for all these varying degrees. But yeah, I think it's a, I think it would be great if society could step up and allow people to go to community college, much like they, I think community college is now becoming what high school was 50 years ago. And so maybe that's a good thing. The bigger question is, will there be tax fatigue finally hitting Seattle? Seattle has sort of famous in almost never turning down a tax because of all of this upset over the homelessness issue, I think, and the spending expenditures on that issue. There may be a significant pushback.
You know, you talk to people that live in Seattle and they're on a fixed income or they're retired and their house has gone up in value, but their income hasn't changed at all. And they're paying $9,000 or $11,000 a year to the city of Seattle for a broken homeless program and a broken school district and the broken roads. And you're at $11,000. You're like, what am I getting for my money? People will eventually start to move out, right? We want to have this great diversity of income, the lower class and middle and the upper class, and we're all getting together and having camping out at Starbucks. Will the city eventually just force those people that can't afford it, that are 60 years old and are not having regular incomes increase by 10% as the taxes increase, do they eventually just move away?
Well, that's a concern, and that's why the city is doing what it can to sort of establish affordable housing so people that are not homeless but aren't bereft. But it is a challenge when the city is getting as a
Where's the money come for the affordable housing? It comes from the person with the fixed income. So you take the person.
Just the fixed income.
Yeah, but let's take it. Let's take where it's coming from.
You take the one particular, or let's take it from the guy who's making a fortune. I mean, the thing is that it is a balance, but it is true. I think in general, the citizens of Seattle are very generous with their taxes because they want to help people less well off. However, we are getting to a point now because it's getting so expensive to live here that even the people that live here may not be able to afford staying here, and that is a dilemma. So I think that you can, in the first case, you could justify on ethical grounds, a good liberal grounds, that maybe raising the taxes right now is not the way to go because it's going to impact people that maybe can't afford it, who hitherto have said yes, I'm in favor of helping out low income families with better educational opportunities at the preschool level.
The argument that is always made, and the conservatives will bite on, is this: if you spend $1 now on education, you save $7 later on when it comes to criminal justice.
Yeah,
and
ideally,
a whole bunch of other stuff, right? Ideally,
yeah.
The research doesn't always bear that out. But if the kid has a choice between sitting at home in front of a television set with a grandmother who's nodding off, or a kid is in a program where at least hopefully they're relating to other kids and there's some actual education going on, I'm okay with that. I'll pay the buck now if I know that we have some metrics to be able to determine this is program working, not just sort of throw them into it like the Head Start program, which has been proven to fail. The idea of actually having effective, so it's working, so it does work, not just, hey, everybody, look at this. We've got this warehouse. We send these kids and they get a chance to color and all that other stuff. Let's see that later on down the road that they put these things in place. So I saw that other states and other cities have created a program very similar to Seattle, but what they did is they did a control group. So they had one control group that didn't have everything that the other preschool did. So then they were able to compare the difference between the money spent on this one and the money not spent on this one. Where are the kids down the road 20 years later?
Yeah. And I think the counter to your take on liberals is, we don't want to spend money and waste money either.
Oh.
We just think that the money spent for a good cause is a reason to
reason enough.
No, it's not reason enough. It's a good thing to do that, but it's true. We don't want to waste the money, and that's the difference. I think in general the cliche is liberals always want to higher taxes and conservatives want no taxes, and it's the in between balance. And the idea is, it's true. Liberals are willing to tax themselves more, but they don't want to just throw their money, good money after bad. So on this homeless situation, I think there's a lot of good impulse, you know, for Seattle voters to help the homeless and to help the low income and help create affordable housing. But at the same time, it's true. If we become convinced, Seattle voters become convinced that the money for the homeless is not being well spent, then we're going to say, well, wait a minute, you know, get your house in order.
Oh, so do you think they've reached that point? Liberals have reached the point where they start to go, geez, maybe if we spend more money, we still have the problem. It's even worse than it was before when we weren't spending as much money. Hey, we'd like some accountability. No. Do you believe that we've awoken the liberal mind to actually metrics and to results, not just causes?
Yeah, but the thing is, the liberal mind has always been woke. That's the idea. The question, though, is at what point do you find something out of balance? 2 years ago, then we went through that entire, you know, homeless crisis and declared an emergency, and now we're rejiggering the estimate. There's still arguments. You can have legitimate arguments on both sides about whether we should be spending the money or not and how we should be spending the money. But it's true. You are not heartless, you conservatives, and we're not spendthrift. We're not just sort of
brainless.
Wasteful.
Brainless. What's the then let me ask you this. What do you think about the fact that community college would be free regardless of income? Because it's a good cause, but now here's an example where conservatives and liberals would part. The liberals like, no, everybody should have a chance. A free society, just like high school. Yeah. Everybody gets a chance to go. So the $5,000 that we would spend for this person when their mom and dad have a net worth of $1 million, are you okay with that?
Okay with restricting it?
No restrictions at all. Because right now the one that Jenny Durkin wants is everybody gets in regardless of income and regardless of what your grades were in high school. All you have to do is have graduated. You might be reading
at an
eighth grade level.
Yeah.
Right, but you graduate and then you
something.
Get a chance to go to community college.
Yes.
So would you put restrictions on that?
Okay, I ideally no, because I think you need to have total buy-in. That's sort of like Social Security. Right now, your dad, for instance, he was, you know, worth a fortune, but he also was guaranteed because of a Social Security. He was guaranteed Social Security money.
Right.
And they say, well, but he didn't need it. But the thing is, if you get buy-in from everybody in society, we don't know how things will work out. Maybe your dad could have been destroyed in one of the crashes, and then he could have used it.
No.
The idea here is that if you open it to everybody, then you've got complete and total buy-in.
Social Security is a bad example. You know what's a good example? It's Medicare. He didn't need Medicare.
Okay,
right?
Medicare.
Social Security was, he paid millions of dollars into a program,
that's
and
right.
The return on that thing was less than 1.7% return on his interest. If he had taken that money and invested in the stock market, he would have had far more. So, because all Social Security is take it from the old guy, and take it from the young guy, give it to the old guy. Medicare should be means tested. There's no reason my father should have gotten free Medicare.
Okay.
Absolutely not. That's the program should be means tested.
Okay. And so when it comes to community college, my guess is the people that can afford it wouldn't go to community college. They would go to universities and all of this. And so maybe the people, you have to see who is it to help the best. The idea is we want to encourage people that normally wouldn't go to community college for whatever reasons, primarily financial, that's no longer an option.
Majority of those people that are in poverty get all the federal and state funding they need to go to community college for free. It's already there. Take a fast break.
Well, that's not what you hear from a lot of students that say they can't afford it. I don't know who they are that
they should.
You're cutting out of the equation, John.
I'll talk to them. Have them call me. We create the best fighting force in the world because there's something so unique about America. But what if that thing that was so unique about America becomes poisonous? Then what happens to the fighting force? Are they also infected? We're right back. Kiel Mortgage, 1-888-778. KIEL Kiel Mortgage there for you. CL53969. Get taxed out of your house. You want to move somewhere else? Go call Kiel Mortgage. They'll get you a good mortgage. They're good people working over there. Lickety split without a whole lot of hooey, Tom. Says it right there on the side of their vans. Kiel Mortgage has vans.
How do you spell hooey, John?
H O O E. EY.
Yeah, there you go.
Thanks, Tom. I had to say the word and spell the word and say the word again. All right. A long piece in Atlanta, beautifully written. By the way, if you have three or four days coming up in the holiday, if you would like to read something, I suggest this piece called The Plunging Morale of American Service Members. The gentleman is a former Marine, and he also went on, I think, to Brown and graduated with a degree in... seems like literature.
It's so well written.
The guy, yeah, and he walks you through. The basic concept seems to be this, that we always talked about how when Ronald Reagan used to say that we're the heroes, we look for the heroes are the people that live next door, that what makes America great is the fact we have this incredible fighting force because people will fight for freedom. And he said along the sides of the roads in Texas, if someone has lost a life in the military, it'll say both Jesus and this soldier died for your freedom. And the idea that from a great country comes great fighting force. Then he points to, as the country becomes less and less united and people turn their backs on institutions with Congress at 13% and I think 26% for the next institution. Oh, the Supreme Court was at 30% or something mm-hmm. like that. And that as the morale of just the general American citizen drops, then therefore that begins to infect the individuals that will come out of that family, out of that society, and then go fight on a battlefield somewhere else.
Yeah, part of I think his critique, and it's a good analysis because he attacks both Obama administration and the Trump administration. So it's not like a partisan thing.
Right.
From a Marine's point of view, here's part of the problem. He says we don't have a mission, we don't have a goal. It's endless war, and he says with this endless war, what we end up doing is sort of not justifying to the soldiers that are putting their lives on the line, why they're there.
Yeah.
That there's no end result that you can point to. There's no mission, and there's no mission accomplished because there's no mission established. You need to have, a soldier needs to know that, okay, we need to take that hill because that hill will allow us to do this or do that, and we'll have some kind of end result.
Yes.
We've been fighting for almost 20 years now since 9/11, and it's an endless issue fought by the same few people,
yeah,
and not everyone has a buy-in because their draft's long gone away.
Right.
And until we have a way to sort of a metric for that, it's going to undercut any justification for what the soldiers that are living and dying for are doing.
Right. So it has a circumlocutory nature where he says that you're cutting the grass, but you're watering the grass with blood.
Right.
So you're cutting it. So the grass is growing because there's blood on it. So we have to cut it. And then there's just more blood on it because you have to keep cutting it. He says, so that's what happens is, so if you ask the military, those that are in, how they are as far as their just general morale, mm-hmm. since 2009, $287 million has been spent on programming trying to improve morale, but yet 52% of soldiers across the branch remain pessimistic about their future in the military. He said that he had talked to some people that have been on 8 deployments.
Yes.
That they go out, they come back, and they go back out again because they don't have enough people, especially in special ops, to go out there and fight this, what seems like endless war.
Yes. And one of the solutions. So it's a great takedown of the way this country is operating and has for the last decade or two decades. But then he does offer some solutions. One of them is that we have this sort of open-ended thing that was passed by Congress before the Iraq War. That just it's basically open-ended, like the president never has to justify the use of troops, and mm-hmm. Congress never forces the issue. And he says, I think that you need to come to the table. Every 2 years, the president, whoever the president is, Democrat or Republican, needs to come before the American public and justify, okay, here we're going to spend this much time and these many lives to do this particular issue and have the Congress debate it so they can actually come to, you know, this sort of consensus that, mm-hmm. yes, indeed, this is going to happen. He says one of the problems is anybody who challenges what we're doing militarily is then seen as somehow a traitor to the military. And he says, no, the military would appreciate that. The military, in order to put your life on the line, you need to be able to look and realize that the Congress is behind you, that the American people are behind you. Instead, the American people in Congress are missing in action. They're not there to kind of, assert why your life is worth, putting in risk right now.
When it came to whether or not that this is part of this, not part of that survey or not part of that article, but part of the survey from MSNBC, 26% of Army leaders participated agree with a statement that headed in the right direction to prepare for the challenges of the next 10 years. And only 27% of soldiers thought that leadership had their best interest at heart. Can you imagine that? If you had an organization where only 27% were satisfied at the leadership positions. So that's where he says that the two biggest problems, you have two forces happening at the same time. One, a derelict elective individual in Congress or in the Senate, just continually spending money but not really having any focus. And then the second thing was you were producing people that may or may not want to just put their life on the line for their fellow brother unless you have a better idea of why they're fighting in the first place.
Yes. I mean, we need to come up with a justification for what we're doing, or it's all a waste. And he thinks that morale is the one thing that Americans have already sort of prided themselves on because there was always a sense of purpose. But he says, if you do not have a clearly stated mission, he says, for instance, what happens, this particular writer asked at a press conference, President Trump, what happens after ISIS? And he didn't have a response to that except to say, well, I think we should then take their oil.
Yeah.
He says, that is not a coherent policy. We need to work out something that makes some sense. And he also argues that right now, the people that are rah-rah military, he says, it's just a sentimental display because anybody in the military says that this has to be a coordinated effort with diplomacy. And right now, we are undercutting the diplomatic response and just using it to say, hey, I want more scalps, showing people you can kill, but without any kind of coherent mission,
right.
Then it seems to lack any justification. There are no more people in fact, he cites Mattis.
Mattis said if you cut the State Department, I'm going to have to buy more ammunition.
Exactly. And Brilliant. He says that is counterproductive. Yeah. You need to work in hand, and right now there is no intergovernmental coordination. It's a dispiriting article.
It really is.
But it's also a call to arms, you know, but not
I thought the most powerful part was when he brought up the fact that Senator Warren from Virginia asked General Petraeus, did the war in Iraq make America safer? And Petraeus said, Senator, I don't know.
Yeah.
Wow. Right back. All righty. The empty nest syndrome, Tom. You prepare the little birds, and at one point, their wings are strong enough, and they lift up and fly away.
It's a great moment.
Is it a good moment?
Well, there are always crises. It tends to break down on gender lines occasionally.
Uh-huh.
But that moms maybe miss their kids and are all tearful. I know some dads,
You're an empty
too.
Nester, right?
I'm an empty nester, and I think it's been great. I love my kids. If they wanted to move back home, I wouldn't have a problem with it. But they're off in college, and then beyond that, they're living in New York. And it's fantastic when you can just have your wife to... you know, do things with.
Was it sad when they first left?
I didn't feel that way at all. My wife would disagree vociferously. But, I mean, if you have a good relationship with your kids, it's like, fine. In fact, I was laughing when they first went away to college. I probably talked to them more in their first year of college because they were either homesick or asking for advice than I did when we were actually living together. But I thought it was, and I still do think it's a wonderful thing. But it's also wonderful when the kids come back to visit.
So there's a family, and I use the term loosely,
yes.
In New York. I think it's upstate New York. And they've got a 30-year-old kid, and they've asked the kid to leave. And he won't leave.
Yes,
and they asked him nicely a bunch of times, hey, it's about time you leave. You can go get a place on your own. I don't think he has a job. So now they have decided they're going to go to court to evict their son.
That's right. They've done formal requests of his. The very first February of this year, Michael, this is their son, keep in mind. After discussion with your mother, we have decided that you must leave this house immediately. You have 14 days to vacate. You will not be allowed to return. We will take whatever actions are necessary to enforce this decision. And he got a series of these eviction notices. Nothing ever came of it. So finally, they decided to go to court.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Joseph Rotondo. So now they're giving him the middle name. You always know you're in trouble legally.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. You are hereby evicted from, and they give the address. You are heretofore been our guest, and there is no lease or agreement that gives you the right. You have 30 days to leave. Parents offered him, and in fact, then the parents then said, we'll give you $1,100 as part of your moving fee just to get you out of the house. They have these formal complaints. And right now, the son has decided that he is requesting that a judge dismiss his parents' request. So the court is the family solution for both the parents and the son. Right now, they say a court hearing is set for sometime this week.
Is it a good idea or a bad idea to have your house as disinfected as possible? An interesting study comes out of, is this out of the UK or out of Scotland? I can't remember who came up with it, but they did research on childhood leukemia, and that they found out that in homes where there's a tremendous amount of bleaching agents in regard to cleaning from infection.
Not even tremendous amount. Just enough. Very clean, very hygienic situation.
The child's development and the immune system doesn't have a chance to fight off, and therefore the kid is more susceptible to leukemia.
See, this is one of the great things about making preschool available to everybody and anybody in Seattle, because it'll teach you how to deal. Yeah, it'll teach you how to deal with germs. There is a genetic mutation that happens in 1 in 20 kids.
Mm-hmm.
And with if you have that genetic mutation and then you live in a really clean house, sterile environment, you in the first year of life, your body is not used to that, you know, the fighting off the infections, and because of that, it's like a 1-2 punch. Right now, this is the one there's been this increase in childhood acute leukemia in well-to-do, well-developed, very clean, you know, in effect, countries that play by the most medically stringent rules, they're the ones that are suffering the most from this, ironically.
Huh. They say that the kids, they used to be in the 60s or 70s, if you got childhood leukemia, you died from it. Most did anyway.
Yes.
Now, I think within 90%
are cured. Yes.
Save rate. But to know that too clean of a house.
Yeah.
I'd like to see how that breaks down. I mean, what does that mean? That they're always wiping stuff down? That the kid's pacifier falls on the ground, they clean it or sterilize it, or does the old mom put it in her mouth? That move.
Well, the thing is, I don't think in this case they say, we're talking about country, so it's not like an individual, it's like, you know, OCD or something, you know, kind of a obsessive compulsive type. No, it's just, in general, relatively clean houses can backfire if you're one of those kids. Now, one of the things they say, how easy to overcome this. Get your kid in a kind of a preschool situation and or have older siblings because they tend to bring infections a home. They also say if you have a cesarean, you're more susceptible because you haven't dealt with that. And breastfeeding is a good thing to immunize the kid as well.
My mom had this weird condition. She didn't mind us eating bugs.
Well, I see it on TV. You could have been a superstar in one of those.
She actually has us in a high Super 8 film, Eating Spiders.
And that's why you're strong today.
Thank you, Tom.